Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Supreme Court's rulings today striking down a key section of DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, that will now allow gay married couples to receive federal benefits, and a ruling denying proponents of California's Proposition 8 to appeal, clearing the way for same-sex marriage in the Golden State. Jane Schachter, a professor of law at Stanford University and an expert on sexual orientation law, joins us to discuss today's rulings. Then we'll look into President Obama's pledge to take the global lead on assaulting climate change by redoubling U.S. efforts to fight it. One of the nation's leading authorities on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations, David Freeman, joins us to discuss the president's proposal to require the EPA to establish carbon pollution standards for coal-fired power plants, the largest source of carbon emissions in the United States, and the future of the Keystone XL pipeline. Then finally, with the recent passage of a bill in the House restricting abortions and last night's filibuster in the Texas State House to block the implementation of a bill that would have effectively shut down all abortion clinics in Texas, feminist activist Frances Kissling joins us. She writes a weekly column at Salon.com and blogs at ReligionDispatches.org. And we will discuss the renewed war on women's reproductive rights that Republicans are waging at both the state and federal levels, and Texas Senator Wendy Davis's successful 11-hour stand in pink running shoes against one of the toughest anti-abortion efforts in the country. And joining us now is Jane Schachter, a professor of law and associate dean for curriculum at Stanford University. She's a leading national expert on statutory interpretation and legislative process, constitutional law, and sexual orientation law. Previously, she taught law at the University of Wisconsin Law School, as well as the University of Michigan Law School. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jane Schachter.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And overturning this key part of the DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, apparently it sort of releases, if you will, 1,138 federal privileges and benefit programs that use the marital status as a criterion for eligibility. So its effects seem to be actually pretty profound and pretty widespread.
Absolutely. It's never a small thing when a piece of congressional legislation gets struck down, and that's very true here. This DOMA was passed at the height of the backlash when same-sex marriage first kind of burst onto the scene as a possibility. And in one fell swoop, it disqualified couples who might be married under their state's law from participating in, as you say, well over 1,000 benefits. And these are significant benefits: veterans benefits, Social Security, tax benefits, immigration, other kinds of things. So to clear DOMA out of the way and to allow the Obama administration to begin taking steps to equalize the situation and recognize all marriages, same-sex or opposite-sex, that a state recognizes is quite a big deal.
And in terms of the case itself, of course, it's a victory for Edie Windsor, an 83-year-old woman who was forced to pay over $360,000 in federal estate taxes when her partner or wife, Thea Speier, died in 2009. And as we were saying, you know, you've got survivor's benefits now, tax-free employee health insurance, IRS perks, emergency leave, green cards and visas, etc. So clearly there is a considerable national significance to this. But tell me about the relationship between the state and federal laws now. Because 37 states in this country still don't recognize same-sex marriage. So there is a different tapestry now, isn't it? For example, if you're married in Massachusetts but live in Alabama, you're not necessarily going to get federal benefits.
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. The federal government is going to have to grapple with how it is going to determine who is married under a state's law, for exactly the reason that your example illustrates. So let's say there's a couple that's married in a law that clearly, in a state that clearly allows same-sex marriage and recognizes same-sex marriage. Then they go to another state that doesn't. Are they married under the state's law or not? So the federal government is going to have to grapple with how they decide that, because the federal government could have its own rule about which state it will look at. All DOMA says is it's not the federal government's job to define marriage. They should go along with what the state says. In a situation where there's a conflict between different states, you know, the federal government might take the position, if you were married lawfully in the state that married you, that's good enough for us.
Again, I'm speaking with Jane Schachter, who's a professor of law and associate dean for curriculum at Stanford University. She's a leading national expert on statutory interpretation and legislative process, constitutional law, and sexual orientation law. And previously, she taught law at the University of Wisconsin Law School, as well as the University of Michigan Law School. Now, this, of course, this ruling in terms of the justices, the so-called liberal minority of four was joined in the majority by the swing state judge.
Yeah, right.
what do you call him? The swinging judge? Not the hanging right. Judge.
Swing voter. I call him the swing vote on the court, and it's very interesting because, you know, you could make a case that Anthony Kennedy is one of the most powerful people in the country because so many issues do come down to his view. What's interesting about Justice Kennedy is that he has written all three of the Supreme Court's major gay rights decisions. He's, of course, an appointee of Ronald Reagan, a Republican appointee, by no means a liberal vote across the board, but he has developed a jurisprudence on gay rights, and you really could see traces of his previous gay rights opinion in this opinion today, because one of the things he appealed to is the idea of how important it is to respect the dignity and the equality and the liberty of same-sex married couples who are married in the eyes of the state, and he says being disrespected and humiliated, even was a word that he used, by the federal government. So it was quite an evocative kind of call for dignity. He paired that with his traditional sympathy for state autonomy and federalism and states' rights as against the federal government. You put those two together, they were a potent combination for Justice Kennedy.
But of course, Jane Schachter, one could argue that the definition of the makeup of the court has changed over the years, and it's an extremely conservative court and has been heading that way for decades. And to call the minority liberal, certainly in terms of the Thurgood Marshalls and William O. Douglas's, I think you could suggest they're more centrist than liberal.
Yeah, I think moderate is a better word for them. There are no Brennan and Marshall liberals on this court, really none of them. Justice, you know, Ginsburg is maybe the clearest link to that, but even she is more moderate on certain issues. So I think that's absolutely true. I think the other thing that's happened with Justice Kennedy in particular, as the court has gotten more conservative. So, for example, the Roberts and Alito appointments didn't change the makeup of the court, but they pulled the court further to the right because both of those justices, I think, are in many ways more conservative than those that they replaced. And I think that you could say that that Justice Kennedy has perhaps been, it used to be, you know, people call it sometimes the Kennedy Court now because he's the swing vote. Sometimes people used to joke and call it the O'Kennedy Court because it was O'Connor and Kennedy who were together as the swing votes. I think that after Justice O'Connor left, in some ways, Justice Kennedy maybe took on more self-consciously the role of being the swing voter. And, for example, his opinions on race, his opinion in the affirmative action case on Monday, was more moderate than many people expected it to be. He used to be, I think, more gave the impression that he was champing at the bit to end affirmative action, and Monday's decision didn't really suggest that. I think ever since Justice O'Connor left, he may feel the weight more of being the swing voter. The other thing to say about this court having any liberals on it I think it's true that they're moderate, and I think the other thing that's true is even though today the court strikes a very significant blow for gay rights, it would be a wild exaggeration to say that this is a court that is really concerned with, in any systematic way, with protecting the rights of minorities. And you need only look at, I think, the devastating decision yesterday on the Voting Rights Act to reach that conclusion. It's quite a juxtaposition and quite a swing from yesterday to today.
Well, it does, and it makes one think of how politics in this country are so balkanized on the left and so dominated by identity politics. You've got yesterday minorities in tears, and today another minority in with tears of joy.
Yes, exactly. It is really quite a contrast. Now, obviously, the issues are very different. And there's a kind of way in which race, I think, is a unique issue, not like anything else. And the justices among them have very strong feelings about that issue. I mean, I thought Justice Thomas's opinion in the voting rights case almost took my breath away with some of the parallels. In the affirmative action case, some of the parallels he was drawing. He actually was talking about the ways that he thinks affirmative action demeans its beneficiaries and made parallels to things that used to be said about slavery and segregated schools. And that was just stunning, really stunning to me. But yes, there's quite a bit of whiplash between today and yesterday.
Well, of course, he can express his ideological predilections, and he is, in many ways, arguably one of the most unsuited for the court, because this is a very bitter man. If you read his biography, it's full of bitterness and anger at those that did what he called the electronic lynching. And it seemed to me that if he looked at what Ward Connolly has done to the University of California's admission program, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It makes you realize that, you know, it's wonderful to have ideology, but when the rubber meets the road, there are a hell of a lot less African-American kids in the University of California system. It's just a fact.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's – I'm editorializing here. Let me get back to these decisions. Jane Schachter, again, professor of law and associate dean for curriculum at Stanford University, where she specialized in sexual orientation law. On the other California case where the Supreme Court dismissed California's Proposition 8 appeal, the majority voted on standing, which is often used as a way to punt serious issues. But it was a strange mix, wasn't it? You had in the majority, you had Chief Justice John Roberts, and then you had Justice Anthony Scalia, and then you had let's call them moderate justices, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer and Elena Kagan. And against the ruling, you had Justice Kennedy, who wrote the dissent, and then he was joined by Justices Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, and Sonia Sotomayor, another moderate. So what do you make of that strange mix?
That was very, very surprising to me, and I don't know quite what to make of it. I think the surprise to me was, in some ways, Justice Kennedy, because Justice Kennedy, at the oral argument in the Prop 8 case, really signaled that he did not seem interested in deciding that case. He a few times raised the possibility of just dismissing it outright as a mistake to have taken in the first place, and that obviously got no traction. But on the standing issue, I think one of the reasons he didn't join the majority on the standing issue is he was very concerned about what the effect would be on the initiative process in California. Of course, he's a child of California, grew up in California, practiced law in California, and seems to have some fondness for the initiative process. And it is a little bit anomalous that you can have a situation where elected officials choose not to defend a measure, and therefore, when that measure is struck down in a trial court, nobody has the standing to appeal it. There are some workarounds and fixes that might be used in the future to avoid that situation, but I think maybe that's what motivated him to not be willing to go along on the standing issue, a fear that elected officials could kind of end run the direct democratic process that is itself supposed to be an end run around them when the voters are unhappy.
Well, but doesn't it, it brings up a very anomalous issue over states' rights, doesn't it, where you have a federal district judge overturning the elected will of the people of California?
Yeah, yes. You know, it's always controversial when an appointed federal judge knocks down something that was enacted by a Democratic body, and never more so than when it's enacted directly by the people. Having said that, there certainly is evidence that the initiative process has historically been used in ways that are very disadvantageous to minorities, not only sexual minorities, but ethnic and racial minorities. And so, you know, there's a lot of arguments about whether the court should be more deferential when it's the voters as a respect for the people, or should be less deferential because there's a lot of risks in that process. And, you know, by and large, the Supreme Court doesn't really factor that much into their decision. That is to say, there's really no evidence that they treat a ballot measure any different than a piece of legislation. It's always controversial, as it was controversial today, and again, to bring up yesterday, as it maybe should have been controversial yesterday for them to strike down the Voting Rights Act. It's controversial for them to strike down the Defense of Marriage Act. I mean, all of these things are still have the legitimacy of a vote and of democratic will, but that's the nature of the Constitution. It imposes limits on what democratic bodies can do.
But what's the exact effect then, Jane Schachter, of this overturning or denying the appeal on Prop 8? Because could it be restricted just to the plaintiffs, a couple here in Burbank, California, and another couple up in Berkeley?
Yeah, that's the question we're about to find out. We'll find more out about. I think that at the end of the day, Judge Walker's decision, the trial court decision that is basically reinstated by the Supreme Court today because no one had standing to appeal from it, I think at the end of the day that will be binding on all counties. The reason is the governor was clearly a defendant in that case. The governor has the authority to direct the actions of the county clerks who issue marriage licenses. And if that's correct, then the fact that he was subject to an order by that trial judge who said you cannot any longer enforce Prop 8, it's unconstitutional, I think gives it statewide effect. Now, having said that, I think what's going to happen is that there are going to be some clerks in more conservative areas of the state that are not going to follow his order and issue marriage licenses once this whole Supreme Court appeal is final in a few more weeks, and the Ninth Circuit says that there's no more bar to action once all the paperwork is done. I think what's going to happen is that some clerks are going to decline to issue licenses, and perhaps at that point some couples may decide to go to court suing the clerk, and we may have an opportunity to litigate whether Judge Walker, the trial judge in the Prop 8 case, actually had the power to order even clerks who were not part of the lawsuit to issue licenses as a result of the governor's order for them to do that.
But the Attorney General Kamala Harris today called upon the Ninth Circuit to clarify things. Now, what can they do?
I think it's unclear whether she just wants them to expedite it or to clarify. I think that this may well end up back in the district court. Now, Judge Walker's not on the bench anymore, so it'll be whoever is going to be his successor in this case. But I think that's where it'll start, in all likelihood. Maybe the Ninth Circuit will chime in, but what the Supreme Court did was they issued an order vacating the Ninth Circuit decision and instructing the Ninth Circuit to send it back to the district court, whose decision would become final. So I expect that's what will happen in due course. And then we'll see if there's going to be further litigation about the scope of the trial court's ruling.
So there won't be a rush to the altar then?
Well, I think it'll be a few weeks. I think as soon as possible, as soon as the green light is given, there are going to be people certainly in places like L.A. and San Francisco who immediately start to marry, who aren't going to wait for any litigation that's going to get in the way of that. But I think it will be a few weeks at least.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Jane Schachter.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Jane Schachter, who's a professor of law and associate dean for curriculum at Stanford University. She's a leading national expert on statutory interpretation and legislative process, constitutional law, and sexual orientation law. Previously, she taught law at the University of Wisconsin Law School, as well as the University of Michigan Law School. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about President Obama's pledge to take a lead in assaulting climate change.
Out of the things you are proud of. If you love this coast, then keep it clean as it evolves, cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will confront.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Freeman, who is a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He has had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under President Jimmy Carter. He also headed the New York Power and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and was the state energy czar responsible for rescuing California from the predations of Enron and Company. David Freeman is the author of Winning Our Energy Independence, and Energy Insider Shows How. Welcome to the program, David Freeman. And apparently we don't have him. I spoke to David a little while ago, so he's definitely expecting our call. So hopefully he will join us momentarily. And in the meantime, I'm trying to figure out whether we have him or not. Obviously, I wanted to talk to him and will talk to him, presuming he shows we get him on the line here, about the couple of issues that came up in President's speech yesterday at Georgetown University, where he said that his administration was going to take the global lead in assaulting, is actually the word he used, climate change, and redouble U.S. efforts to join in the fight. And he specifically talked about setting carbon pollution standards for coal-fired plants, which are starting to be phased out now, largely because of the availability of natural gas. Nevertheless, of course, this has led to fierce opposition from the coal states. And he's also, for the first time, talked about the Keystone XL pipeline, which has been obviously a very controversial issue. And he didn't exactly say how he was going to vote. He said that if the Keystone XL pipeline adds to the CO2, then he would be against it. Now, the Canadians are already saying, their energy minister is already saying the State Department has already said that it won't, but the State Department are reviewing it. So the real question is, what is the renewed or the new improved version of the State Department's study into Keystone XL going to lead to? And specifically what the president said, he said, by the way, it's certainly got to be about more than just building one pipeline. Now, I know there's been, for example, a lot of controversy surrounding the proposal to build the pipeline, the Keystone pipeline, that would carry oil from Canadian tar sands down to refineries in the Gulf. And the State Department is going through the final stages of evaluating the proposal. That's how it's always going to be. But I do want to be clear, allowing the Keystone pipeline to be built requires finding that doing so would be in our nation's interest. And our national interest will be served only if this project does not significantly exacerbate the problem of carbon pollution. The net effects of the pipeline's impact on our climate will be absolutely critical to determining whether this project is allowed to go forward. So that is I don't know that whether that satisfies anybody's concerns one way or the other, because it doesn't exactly say what he's going to do over this. So we'll see whether or not he is able to use the State Department authorization one way or the other. But as I say, the Canadians seem to think that the ruling is going to go in their favor. And of course, this is a very conservative, pro-energy government now in Canada, under a prime minister from the oil state of Alberta. And again, we were hoping to talk about the president's speech yesterday. And his speech, of course, was on an opportunity for him to clarify his position on the environment. It turns out that in a recent poll, 47% of Americans think the government is doing too little to protect the environment, and that is certainly the case. And it would seem that if the president rules in favor of the Keystone Pipeline, I think he's going to take a huge hit from the environmental community, and that number may well go up. Again, we're hoping to get David Freeman on the line. Again, we're trying to talk about the important issue of what the president said yesterday. Of course, yesterday we had to cover the extraordinary ruling from the Supreme Court striking down the key part of the Voting Rights Act, which was probably one of the great disasters in terms of Supreme Court rulings since Citizens United. It's certainly it will prove to be on a similar scale. And just as Citizens United has helped the Republican Party enormously, I don't think there's much doubt that this will also be an extraordinary boon for the Republicans, who will be able to suppress votes in enormous amounts of, particularly in the southern states, but also in a lot of the other red states. So we're still hoping to hear from David Freeman here, and I'm absolutely mystified as to why we can't get him on the line. Again, this is a background briefing. This is, unfortunately, a live show. I don't know why this is happening, and it's difficult to communicate here because I'm somewhat at a loss to know what is happening. But hopefully soon we will find out one way or the other whether we have David Freeman. Okay, well, apparently he's somehow not answering the phone. Maybe we should try somebody else on another subject, if we can. This is unfortunate because David's an old friend of mine. I've known him for years. It's absolutely mystifying to me as to why he is not on the line. I spoke to him a little while ago, so he was definitely wanting to do this. And, of course, he's played a very real role in trying to stop the nuclear power plant down here, south of here, San Diego, from being reopened. And as it happened, I mean, obviously other people are involved, but indeed the utility only finally came to their senses and decided to close the plant. And now, of course, I think efforts will be made to try and close down the other one at Diablo Canyon. So I'm telling you what I was talking to David about, discussing here today before he came on, before I came on the air. And again, we're hoping that at some point or other we either get David on or we move on maybe to talk to somebody else about these Supreme Court rulings. We are going to try some other people here. Again, this is a live program, and for some reason or other, one of our live guests didn't show, and I have absolutely no idea why that is happening. But I'm going to try and hope that we bring you somebody here very soon. This is unfortunate that we weren't able to cover the president's speech on the environment yesterday. So, any rate, now we're going to go back to the other subject that we were talking about earlier, which is the Supreme Court rulings, and I have, which came out, of course, today. I have Jessica Levinson on, who's a professor at Loyola Law School, where she focuses on election law and governance issues, including campaign finance, ethics, and state budgets. She wrote an amicus brief for the Supreme Court in McCormish versus Bennett, the case in which John Roberts and four other justices ruled to limit public funding in elections. And she's the editor of the blog Polawtics. That's polawtics.com. And it has an article. Well, thank you so much for joining us at this last minute, Jessica. I'm so glad to have somebody to talk to. I was getting tired of talking to myself.
I'm so glad to talk to you, as always. So this is working out well already.
So we were speaking earlier with a law professor at Stanford, who was on these two rulings, and I asked her about this odd mix in the rulings in terms of the makeup of that court. You know, you had the four. Who are called liberal justices, and by the way, we discussed the idea of them being called liberals, which the press do routinely in referring to the four minorities on the minority four on the court. That is indeed a misnomer. That there aren't any liberals on the court. They are moderates, but in terms of the DOMA ruling. Justice Kennedy joined the four moderates, but then on the other Prop 8, denying the appeal on Prop 8, you had a strange mixture of Kennedy being on the other side with some of the very conservative judges, and Roberts being on the other side with some of the liberal judges. So. Let's start with that. What did you make of that odd mixture, and particularly the dissent that came from Kennedy in the Prop 8 case that indicated he was concerned about a federal judge overturning the will of the people in a state referendum?
Well, I mean, first, what do I make of the difference in the breakdown of the justices? Well, you know, two totally different cases that have been lumped together because they both deal with equal rights, with gay rights. But in fact, the Prop 8 case, as you know, and likely just talked about at length, the Perry case has nothing to do with the gay rights. It has to do with standing of ballot measure proponents. So, in that case, I think actually it's not at all surprising that there would be an entirely different split in the court. And this is the criticism of the Prop 8 decision, and this will continue to be the criticism. You know, the argument goes, well, there's a ballot measure, it's passed by 90% of the electorate, and then if the Attorney General and the governor don't like it and fail to defend it, essentially, one trial court judge can overturn the will of the people. That's not how I see this, but I think that's certainly been the criticism of that certainly has been and will be the criticism of the Prop 8 decision.
And what could happen then this? I mean, there's still some work to be done, clearly, the ruling could be just narrowed to the four plaintiffs involved, the couple in Burbank and the couple up in Berkeley, and unless there's some clarity. And the Attorney General, Kamala Harris, has asked for some clarity from the Ninth Circuit. But our earlier guest was saying that maybe some clerks in various parts of the state might decide, you know, on their own that they don't approve of it. So when do you think the clarity will come? Obviously, people can't rush out and get married.
Right. So usually it takes the Ninth Circuit about 25 days to lift a stay. Kamala Harris, as you know, has asked for an expedited lifting of that stay. You know, so there was some chatter before the decision came out. If it's based on standing, is it going to be that it was just the plaintiffs from Alameda and Los Angeles County, that it would be just in those jurisdictions where Prop 8 was overturned? It looks to me, as the news and analysis progresses throughout the day, that this is really going to be applicable to all of California, in large part because the governor, who was ironically the attorney general who failed to defend Prop 8, and the new attorney general are very forcefully saying Prop 8 is invalid in California, period, not in portions of California. But, you know, to get back to your broader point of where do we go from here, well, you know, this is not a strong statement in favor of gay rights. This is a strong statement that says if you come to federal court, you better have an injury. It better be caused by what you're complaining about, and we better be able to remedy it if we give you a favorable outcome. So, you know, that's, again, that's what this decision hinges on. And I think, frankly, the criticism is a bit misplaced, because the judge did in this case exactly what members of the judiciary are supposed to do. They are supposed to be the last stop on the train to tyranny of the majority, and the ballot initiative process can lead to majoritarian oppression. And what the court did here is it looked at the Equal Protection Clause, you know, District Court Judge Vaughn Walker, and he said, no, this violates the Equal Protection Clause. Prop 8 is invalid. And that now becomes the law of the land in California, I think, and the Supreme Court's decision becomes the law of the entire nation when it comes to ballot measure proponent standing.
So Kennedy was joined in the dissent on the Prop 8, denying the appeal on Prop 8, and likely opening, clearing the way for same-sex marriage here in the state of California. He was joined by Clarence Thomas and Sonia Sotomayor, who's on the moderate side. And, of course, Clarence Thomas and Justice Alito are extremely conservative. So that was the strange mix. But in the other case, Scalia was very upset and sort of ranting about sodomy and stuff like that. So, what was his? What did you make of his dissent in?
In the DOMA case. The DOMA case, the Windsor case, is the case that actually deals with what we're talking about, which is gay rights. And as I'm sure you've discussed, that case says, you know, the federal government doesn't get to deny same-sex couples that are legally married in their state federal benefits, Social Security benefits. In this case, the Windsor case had to deal with estate taxes. So there are a lot of federal benefits that people like me, who are married to someone of the opposite sex, get, which as of yesterday, same-sex couples couldn't get. And this is the more classic liberal-conservative divide that people expected to see. Kennedy, you know, it's the Kennedy court. So Kennedy is joins the, as you will say, moderate wing. And then we see the kind of conventional, what we all expect, conservative wing. This is not a surprise from Justice Scalia. He has moral problems with gay marriage. I'm trying to be somewhat euphemistic here, and he really had a big problem with the fact that the court did not just apply a lower level of scrutiny, and that's what I think the big story is coming out of DOMA, which is that the majority actually applied a fairly heightened standard of review, saying, we're really going to look at this law with a suspicious eye. And what Justice Scalia said is, no, we really should give the federal government the benefit of the doubt here. Justice Scalia being upset with the outcome and saying, you should have applied something more akin to rational basis.
I brought it up because I, in a curious way, what Scalia was saying is that you have to, you know, you can't trample on the feelings of people who are in the dissent. And in many ways, I thought, curiously enough, that could apply to the Prop 8 ruling, because it did pass by a majority of 52% in the state of California. But then if you had it over again, my understanding is that current polling indicates that Prop 8 would be voted down substantially. So I'm just wondering whether it's healthy for a country to have a look. Well, after the ruling yesterday, let's face it, the minorities have got being shafted in the most blatant way. But the idea that you leave people high and dry, maybe it's a better thing to do to for the state of California to go ahead and have another referendum. I guess it's not likely, though, right?
I think it's probably not likely after the ruling here, but, you know, as you said, a big part of the story is the initiative process in California. And a big part of the story, I mean, what you're bringing up, I think, is so important, and I'm not going to be the first or last law professor to say this, which is, you know, the conservative members of the court tend to care a lot about states' rights in certain cases, and then they don't. So, you know, we can certainly pick apart the decisions that came out in the last 2 days. I mean, the Voting Rights Act decision, I think, very disappointing on a number of levels, but the court didn't actually go as far as it could have. And then these decisions, again, what we're talking about in large part, as you said, is a power play between what do the people get to do through the initiative process when they're standing in the shoes of legislators, these citizen legislators, what do our state legislators, our elected representatives get to do, and then what do our federal representatives get to do? And the judiciary is typically the arbiter of that power play. I think your question brings up the problem of, are the members of the court always consistent on this? And I think the answer has to be no.
Well, I thank you for stepping in here and helping us out, Jessica. I'm very grateful.
Always. It's always a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Jessica Levinson, who teaches law at Loyola University, and she has joined us here at the last minute. We're about to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the renewed Republican war on women's reproductive rights.
Change if they were to find themselves in it. Supporters of the H-bomb and firebombing clinics.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is feminist activist Frances Kissling. She was president of Catholics for Choice until her retirement in 2007. She's currently a visiting scholar at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, and she serves on the advisory boards of the Journal of Feminist Ethics and the Women's Bioethics Project. She is a consultant to the Western Hemisphere region of the International Planned Parenthood Federation, where she develops and conducts value clarification workshops for doctors and nurses working on reproductive health in Latin America. She writes a weekly column for Salon.com and blogs at religiondispatches.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frances Kissling.
Hi, Ian. How are you? I'm just on a plane that landed, so I hope we don't get too many announcements.
Don't worry. We're on a roll.
Okay.
And you're just back from Honduras, where you've been working on women's reproductive health in Latin America. But here in Los Angeles, I believe, you're being honored by WRAP, which is the Women's Reproductive Rights Assistant Project. That's WRRAP. They're naming you scholar and activist of the year, I guess, and along with the other activist Sandra Fluke at their event tomorrow night between 6 and 8 p.m. Here in Beverly Hills. And if anybody wants to go and see Frances Kissling and Sandra Fluke, where there will be a vigorous discussion after they get the awards reception. They can go to wrrap.org/events. That's wrrap.org/events. So you're here to be honored, but this seems to me that this war against women's reproductive rights, it sort of reminds me of what happened yesterday in the Supreme Court ruling, striking down the Voting Rights Act, saying that somehow we no longer have a problem with discrimination, which is, of course, is absurd, because the Republicans in all of these states have a myriad of new and improved modern Jim Crow devices that they keep coming up with all the time to nibble away at the voting rights of minorities. But they also do the same thing on the abortion issue. In fact, more relentlessly and more persistently do they nibble away at Roe v. Wade. And a little over a week ago in the House, they voted for the most repressive abortion law in many decades. And then last night in the Texas State House, there was this extraordinary filibuster by Senator Wendy Davis, who stood for 11 hours in her pink running shoes against one of the most pernicious of these many laws that was about to pass. And this would effectively force all of the abortion clinics in Texas to bring the clinics up to the standards of expensive hospitals, which would effectively bankrupt them. So the devices are so manifest and devious. This is not a battle that's going to go away, is it?
No, definitely not. And I think that we've seen over the last several years, increasingly in state after state, in many, many states, the passage of laws that restrict women's rights in these arenas, and really, it's actually quite shocking. I think that one of the things about Texas that was so energizing, however, was the fact that was Wendy Davis's filibuster, which really gained national attention with over 100,000 people watching it live streaming, and the number of activists who were there in the chamber and were really quite vocal and quite vigorous. I have a feeling, I'm not generally the most optimistic person on this issue, but I have a feeling that that there is a sense within the women's community and among sensible people that enough is enough, and perhaps we are now going to see a much more vigorous defense of reproductive rights and the right to choose abortion than we've seen in the last several years, in the last decade. I think that finally it must be clear to people that that this is not going to stop, and that that these rights are being seriously eroded. And I would hope that the Jim Crow decision would also wake people up to some of the dangers that exist within the Supreme Court.
Well, but do you see an analogy there between these devices that are used that are dishonest and are labeled in the case of voting rights suppression or voter suppression? Then they are labeled as helping voting rights and bringing about modernization and all of that stuff. And the same with the abortion anti-abortion people. They keep saying that. We're only trying to protect women's health. And I guess that horrible abortion doctor guy that they brought to trial recently is an enormous gift to them. But it's always couched in this language. They're actually trying to help when clearly they are completely dishonest about what their real motives are, which is to essentially outlaw abortion altogether and put women back to the 1950s.
I think that's been the danger, is that, it's presented as, for example, the really outrageous things with transvaginal ultrasounds that was so active last year, it's presented as the gold standard of women's health. And why wouldn't those of us who are activists really want to see that kind of thing available to women? And in this case, why wouldn't we want to see clinics up to the highest standards? And, you know, it totally belies, as you say, the motive, which is to make all abortion unavailable. And, you know, it's the same tactics that we've actually seen from the very beginning. The first restrictions that came on abortion were the restriction on the use of Medicaid funds for poor women. Now, all of these measures are designed to make access to the procedure very, very hard. We now know that about 47% of abortions at present are being performed for women who are poor and low income. And so these kinds of measures are the very measures that make it impossible for those women to get those health services.
So, again, I'm speaking with Frances Kissling, who's president of Catholics for Choice until her retirement in 2007. She's currently a visiting scholar at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, and she serves on the advisory boards of the Journal of Feminist Ethics and the Women's Bioethics Project. She's a consultant to the Western Hemisphere region of the International Planned Parenthood Federation, where she develops and conducts value clarification workshops for doctors and nurses working on reproductive health in Latin America, and she writes a weekly column for Salon.com and blogs at religiondispatches.org. So do you think that the House recently passing this draconian anti-abortion legislation, which is one of the most severe attacks, I think, in decades, what are the chances of that backfiring? Now, in the case of this heroic filibuster where the Senator Wendy Davis stood on the floor for over 11 hours in her pink tennis shoes and managed to stop this bill from going into effect and ran out the clock. They, of course, the Texas legislature, which is dominated by conservatives, and of course, Governor Perry is an arch conservative, albeit a somewhat dim-witted one. They're already saying that they've got all kinds of ways that they're going to get around it and start again, and they're declaring victory in the face of defeat. But what about the politics at the national level with the House? Do you think my understanding is that people that are obsessed with women's bodies, and that they essentially are getting a moral free ride because they can feel self-righteous about not killing babies. At the same time, they don't want to take care of these babies at all once they're born. So there's a manifest hypocrisy in this idea that you can care about somebody else's womb as though you had jurisdiction over it. So tell me what's your reading on whether or not at the federal level, in terms of the population of this country, overall, are these anti-abortion people going to win at the end of the day, or are they going to lose?
Well, I think that they are going to lose. I think that, you know, in the short term, the reality is that the Senate and the President are the protection that we have. And it's the House that's filled with really quite a number of crazies on the abortion issue. I think that what we're seeing is that, that the overreaching is actually what's resulting in a reaction, a positive reaction towards abortion rights. I mean, you have the doctor in the House who's name I can't remember, who was very much in the leadership of this measure, saying that fetuses could masturbate, and if they can experience pleasure, then they can also experience pain. And I think those kinds of comments, and particularly often the relationship now or the hostility to women who have been raped or who are victims of incest, is really causing an outrage among people. So I do think that we will see in the elections in 2014 this being a much more vital issue in the congressional races. And I think we will see some people lose their seats because of it.
Well,
ultimately, that's what works.
So do you think then, for example, that there are more people down in Texas than we thought, that maybe in these red states they're not quite as dominated? Maybe they are politically dominated by these Christian Coalition Right to Life people. It's obviously a lot of people were gratified to see Senator Wendy Davis take this stand. I'm just wondering how alone she is in those states. I suspect she's not quite as alone as people think she is.
Well, I think in Texas that she really has a good opportunity, and that Texas is a state that could go blue again. So there, I think there's hope. I also think that your earlier comments about comparing this to the Jim Crow decision is very valid and might also influence things in 2014, because it may not be that some people come out and vote for a more progressive legislators because of the abortion issue, but definitely because of the issues related to race. And I think that, one of the big myths in the abortion field is the myth that Hispanics and black people are less pro-choice than the white population. And that's simply not true. And I think, again, as we see a broader reaction to regressive policies, that also is going to spill over into the abortion and the family planning issue.
Well, the irony is, of course, that the ruling that came down yesterday, voiding the Voting Rights Act for preclearance, the very what the Voting Rights Act stopped in the last election was the Texas redistricting plan, which now is back in force. And guess what? Wendy Davis, the senator, is going to be redistricted out of existence because of yesterday's Supreme Court ruling. So there you have it. I thank you for joining us, Frances Kissling, again,
thank
the president of Catholics for Choice until her retirement in 2007, currently a visiting scholar at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. She serves on the advisory boards of the Journal of Feminist Ethics and the Women's Bioethics Project, and is a consultant to the Western Hemisphere region of the International Planned Parenthood Federation, where she develops and conducts value clarification workshops for doctors and nurses working on reproductive health in Latin America. She writes a weekly column for Salon.com and blogs for ReligionDispatches.com. And tomorrow night she's going to be honored as a Person of the Year by Women's Reproductive Rights Assistant Project, that's WRRAP, along with political activist Sandra Fluke. That's at 6 p.m. tomorrow in Beverly Hills. You can get tickets by going to rap.org/events. That's WRRAP.org/events. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was now.